In the words of the ancient poet, "Today is the day the Lord has made. Let us therefore be glad and rejoice in it." It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Would the children like to come up on stage, please? I have a story that's kind of a favorite story of mine. I may have told it here a year or two ago, so some of you may have heard it before. If so, this will be the second time. It's a story that happened long ago and far away, the way stories happen. It was in a little village somewhere in a valley. And high up on the cliffs by the valley, people said there was a great stone face carved in the rocks of the cliff. That was very difficult to see, because usually clouds covered the tops of the cliff and you could hardly see anything up there. But even if it was a clear, bright day, nobody could agree on quite where they thought the face was or quite what they thought it looked like. But they were sure there was a great stone face up there. And this was important because they also had stories, many stories, about the time that the great stone face had spoken to them, years and years and years ago. And they had stories about the kinds of things the great stone face had said. And it knew all the answers. It knew who they were supposed to be and how they were supposed to live. It knew what was right and what was wrong, what good people do, what good people don't do. It knew all the things that they struggled so hard to try to find answers to, just like you do and like we all do. And they would argue about it, and they had different stories about what they thought the great stone face said, but almost everyone in the village would say that down deep, they really believed they were living in the way that they knew the great stone face would have wanted them to live, if only it would speak again. Now, for most people, this just meant that they thought they were supposed to live in ways that were kind to other people, that were honest, that treated other people well. And that's mostly what they thought the great stone face said. Some saw a much meaner stone face and thought that the great stone face said that they could beat up anybody they were stronger than and take anything they could get away with. But they too were sure that's how the great stone face would have wanted it. And many others argued with them that no stone face that wanted things like that could ever be considered great. That would be an awful face that would say things like, be mean to people. And there were some who said, this is all silliness. There isn't any face up there in the rocks at all. And it's true, if there was a face, it was very, very hard to see. And very few people could agree on what they thought it was like or could agree on what they thought it said. But it was a story they could not get out of. Over and over, year after year, they'd talk about what the great stone face would have said and how it would want them to live. And even if they didn't believe there was a face up there, the question about who they were and how they're supposed to live and what's good and bad and right and wrong were questions that were more important to them than anything else. Well, as you can hear, this isn't settled. They haven't settled it in that little valley, and we haven't settled it here either, because we still talk about who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to live. How do good people act? How do good people not act? And for us, too, these are some of the most important questions that we have. When you get home today, you can talk to your parents about this story and what they think it's about. They should be on the spot, too. But for now, that's all of the story that I have to tell you. So the story's over, and you can go to your classes. in the center of our service and the center of our lives. Let us bring it down to make room for the silences in our lives. The silences behind our words, between our beliefs and our intent. The silences between our head and our heart. The silences that contain so much which seems so hard to put into words. During these first minutes, you may use the time to light candles of memory and hope, or just sit quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here this morning. We use words to move us toward an awareness that is beyond the reach of words. We offer prayers not to appease a powerful creature, but to awaken ourselves, to take ourselves more seriously, to remind us of our higher possibilities and nobler callings. We pray that we can feel safe enough to remove our masks and the hard crust created by our fears. Let us get in touch again with our soft center, the place of hope, doubt, vulnerability, and openness. Let us be open to those softer voices within us, the pleadings of our most tender mercies, the inspiration of the angels of our better nature. Words fail us in prayer. These things don't have clear names, though they come from real yearnings. But we don't have to know what to call them so long as we can call them forth. Let us call forth those gentle hopes and tender mercies and say, be with us here, be with us now, be with us always, and let us live in ways that are worthy of all that is most sacred. Amen. Sometimes sermon titles are so narrow, preachers struggle to figure out how to find enough to say to fill the time. This is one of the other kind. It could certainly generate and has generated thousands of sermons, and I can only touch on a few parts of it. You'll think of a dozen subjects and 50 questions left unaddressed today, and that's as it should be. I want to start just with some words. I think there's an elephant that's been in the room of religious discussion for centuries that we seem to take great pains to avoid noticing. One question everyone here has been asked, you see or hear of it in every pseudo-religious poll ever taken, as though it were a really important question, is the question, do you believe in God? I want to say the question is incoherent. If the question were so important, why wouldn't we want to be clear about what the word meant first? Because when you've defined what you mean by the word God, the question pretty much dissolves. And it's clear whether it's something people would want to believe in or not. Now, there are a lot of levels of this, but I'll take only two. Very broad differences between two styles of religion that have been here as long as religions have been around. A literal style of religion and a liberal style of religion. Change one letter and you change a whole world. For a literal style of religion, whether it's Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, it doesn't matter. The words and fantastic stories of religions mean exactly what they say. They're facts. The gods are some sorts of beings somewhere, even if we can't see them. They live somewhere, even if we can't find it. They speak the way we would speak, only with a lot more power, probably louder. to think this way means that part of being religious in literal styles of religion means that you have to think differently about religion than you think about other parts of your life. You live in a world where we know there's nothing above the sky but infinite space and a lot of cold. And yet, when you come to church, you put on a different kind of mind and think in different ways to say, no, there's a kind of parallel universe where all the gods are there and heavens are there and the rest of it is there. Liberal styles of religion have always taken a very different route, whether in Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, or any other faith. They've always said, no, this is fundamentally misunderstanding what religion has been about. What religion is doing is using poetic words and stories to talk about things that are very real, but not in physical ways, that are very important, but don't exist in the way that you and I and dogs and cats and houses do. They exist instead in the way that ideas and concepts exist. Liberals will say the word like God is a symbol that's like a lot of other powerful symbols we have, like truth, justice, goodness, beauty, even America. There's nothing physical there either, and yet they're more powerful and necessary for life than almost everything we know that is physical. So liberals would say, we're not living in a world watched over by judging, often angry gods. We're living in a world instead of many, many stories about gods told by thousands of religions. No two stories quite the same. Amazing stories, rich, wonderful stories about gods that created the universe and created us and did it differently in each religion. But they're about stories. In other words, that dealing with religion in life is a lot like living in the valley with the great stone face up in the cliff. It wouldn't matter if there'd ever been a stone face that spoke. No one's alive who heard it, and no one who thinks they hear the voices can agree about what it says. What matters is that we have these stories, and something about them is terribly important as long as we can understand them in the right way. I want to throw together some ideas from wildly different directions to try to sketch the sort of picture I want to sketch for you this morning. The first was a comment made by South American writer Jorge Borges, or George Borges, if you like. He's written something I use at most memorial services that I do. Borges says that we die twice. We die twice. The first death comes, he says, when the physical body gives out and isn't here anymore. But the second and more important and final death, he said, comes only when there is no one left to tell our story. Religions are like this, and gods are like this. There have been thousands and thousands of gods in history. Most of them are long dead. We don't even know the names of most of them. And they too die in stages. The first death comes when the way we understand the world no longer gives a place for that sort of a god to live. The second death comes when even the stories aren't interesting enough to retell. In Western religion, as many have observed, we've been between the first and second death of the Western God for centuries. We may remain between those two deaths for centuries more. The stories are powerful and can live on and on and on. It feels important to tell those stories. I wonder why it feels important to tell stories. The Greek gods, to pick safe ones, are gods and goddesses that everyone knows have been dead for over 2,000 years. And yet their stories aren't dead. My goodness, we name all of our spaceships after their gods. Their stories are still very much with us. Why is it important to tell the stories? Well, here's an idea from a completely different culture. In the Hindu tradition, very complicated religion, they have two huge stories or poems or epics that they tell and have told for many, many centuries. The longer one is the Mahabharata, several times longer than the Iliad and Odyssey combined. The shorter one, still fairly long, is the Ramayana, or the stories about the god Rama. I'm reading the Ramayana now. It's fascinating. And already, in the beginning of it, there's been a scene with an amazing insight into religion and life. Very early on, the god Rama trusts Hanuman, a character named Hanuman. He entrusts Hanuman with his story. And then he grants Hanuman a kind of conditional immortality. And he says that Hanuman will live as long as he keeps Rama's story alive. So Hanuman has a vested interest in keeping the story alive. You've heard of the story of Scheherazade from another tradition, the story of her 1001 tales on the Arabian Nights. Scheherazade was a young woman who lived in a place where there was a hateful and evil king who hated women for a variety of complicated reasons. And each night had a young woman brought to him, spent the night with her, and murdered her in the morning. So many women were dying that Scheherazade offered to be one of the women to try to convert the heart of the king. And on the first night, before they went to sleep, she said, "I have a story I want to tell you. It's a wonderful story. Let me tell you a story before we go to sleep." He thought, "All right." And she began the story, and it was intriguing, but it ended in midair. And she said, "That's really enough. I can continue it tomorrow." And so the king let her live another day because he wanted to hear how the story ended. Scheherazade was no dope. And the story went on for 1001 nights. And during those 1001 nights, she reached past his hard crust to his tender core, found his heart, and converted the king from something hateful into something loving. That's why we tell the stories. The God of the Old Testament had kind of a life cycle. He began, as many biblical scholars have said, as a kind of projection of a tribal chief, as an authoritative man who made the rules and set the boundaries and rewarded those who obeyed and punished those who disobeyed. The covenant between the God of the Old Testament and his people was modeled, as many others have shown, on ancient Canaanite or Hittite treaties between minor rulers and their people to keep their people from obeying other rulers and promising them protection if they remain true. And the covenant has been modeled even paragraph by paragraph on these old treaties. By the time of Christianity, people spoke as though this God existed up above the sky, because in the first century they saw the world as being just three stories: this flat pizza-shaped earth where we live, and then up above the dome of the sky was where the gods and the angels and the good figures lived. It's where light and enlightenment and illumination came from. And then below the earth was where horrible, evil, bad, mean demons lived. It was the place of fire and brimstone, and they would point this out to you and say, "There's all the scientific proof you need of this. Just look at the stuff that comes up in volcanoes, and you see what's down there. It's a place of fire and brimstone." up above the sky was the place where good people could go somehow. And bad people would go somehow down below the earth. That was the world that the God of Christianity took shape in. But for centuries now, we don't live in that world anymore. The word God doesn't exist in that way. So that kind of a God, a fellow, a critter living above the sky, has died for most Westerners a long time ago, even though they don't talk about it, because the implications of that death are fairly staggering. And people aren't sure what to do with them. And that leaves the stories, which are still with us. For some of you here, those stories are positive and profound and powerful. Some of you here had negative and hurtful experiences with those stories, and the stories are, at worst, evil. But they're powerful. Now, the good news and the bad news is that the stories have been entrusted to religions, or at least they've been claimed by them. And all of the different religions teach their stories, and their stories of God as they understand God, they teach them as true stories, as you know. It's as though God made these pronouncements long ago, before human history. They were somehow faithfully recorded, and we preachers have an inside track into knowing just what God said and meant and wants. And so, on Sunday, we tell you, and you obey, and you pay us for it. It's not a bad racket. In part one of this two-part series, I joked about saying that the better divinity schools and better courses in religion have hidden secret courses that we take that you can't take. And that's where we learn these secrets that you pay us to tell you on Sundays. There really is something to this. I remember some of those courses and some of those secrets and how surprised I was to hear them. There really is something to this. Doesn't that make you feel awful? And at the risk of incurring punishment from the union of those who protect religious secrets from the people in the pews, I want to tell you one of those stories that I heard that revealed one of the secrets that I'd never understood as clearly or fully until I heard that story. Don't tell anyone I told you. I'll deny it. It's a story Joseph Campbell reported on, though some other archaeologists and sociologists of religion had studied it too, about an amazing and gory ceremony from an Australian tribe, a tribe that used what they called the bull roarer. Now, some of you may have seen programs, television programs on the Discovery Channel, where they show you these now, and where you hear the sound this amazing thing makes. It's actually a sacred relic and a deadly secret. So the fact that they can show it and give the secret away on television means there are ways in which that Australian tribal religion is dead. A bull roarer is a long stick with a slot in it, attached to a rope, and the men of the tribe would spin this bull roarer in circles over their head. And as it gains speed, it makes the most amazing sound, if you've heard this, either in person or on television. It's a sound that's kind of like a... It's very eerie. What they used this for, and again, the bull roarers were secret, sacred objects. Only a select group of men in the tribe could even know they existed. And you keep the secret under penalty of death. They're very serious about this. There was a story of one chieftain's daughter, teenage daughter, who found his bull roarer hidden under his bedding when she straightened up the tent and brought it out and asked him what it was. She was killed for it by the chieftain. They're not kidding. These are deadly, sacred secrets to the tribe. But I'm going to tell you the secret. At initiation of young men, the select men of the tribe who control the secret and the bull roarer come and kidnap a young man, 13, 14, 15-year-old young man. And they kidnap him from his family. This is high ritual. It's done the same way, and the drama is played out the same way each time. They kidnap the man. His mother feigns protection of him, but then yields to these powerful demon spirits in masks because she knows the play too, even though she can't talk about it. They take this young man into the woods, the man who is in many cases absolutely terrified. They tie him to a sacrificial table. And they perform bloody rites of circumcision and subincision, words that make every male cringe. The man, young man has to be terrified, these masked monsters performing rites, while in the background he's hearing the noise of the bull roarer. He knows that it's that noise connected with what's happening to him. Then at the end of this bloody ritual of initiation, this amazing thing happens. One of the men dips the tip of the bull roarer in the young man's own blood. And he brings it up close to his face to show it to him. And then he takes off his mask. And he whispers, "We make the noises." And now the boy is a man. And he could never have become a man in that tribe if he hadn't been told that secret. And from now on, he's charged with protecting the secret and protecting everything that goes with the secret. Now he'll make the noises too. And he'll learn that the noises that he's to make are noises to scare the people of the tribe whenever, just coincidentally, the men of the tribe feel that the people are going astray. And they go into the woods at night and they make these noises of the angry gods with the bull roarer to terrify everyone. And the next day, some of the men who've learned the secrets explain to the tribe why the gods are angry and what the gods want and what the people are to do. Learning about religion is a lot like this without the blood. When you read more and more theologians and historians of religion and philosophers, especially if you're reading in several different religions, there comes the moment when something fairly frightening or liberating, depending on how you look at it, occurs to you. And what occurs to you is, we make the noises. The words written about the gods and goddesses of history aren't written by them. They're the words written by men and women who are telling the stories of what they want to be taken as God. We make the noises. The second thing you learn in religion, and sometimes it's hard to relearn it, the first one shocks you so much you think the whole thing has been a sham and you don't want any more to do with it. You just want to go tell the secret, but you can't just go tell the secret. There's more to it than that. Because the second thing you have to learn is that the reason we're making the noises is because there is something terribly important involved that's beyond words, that is fearful, that people must know, and that we must try to tell them. And that's what the rest of education and religion, I think, is about. Knowing that we make the noises, and knowing that the noises must be in the service of something we consider essential or sacred. Now, this isn't just about gods. This is true of almost all the really important words that we use to structure our world and our life. It's true about words like love or justice or even America. You know, none of those things exists as a critter or a being. We make pictures of them all because it's easier to talk about them that way. We've got millions of love songs telling us what love says and wants and does and how good or bad it is, depending on which side of it you happen to be that day. We create this cute little naked baby. For the Greeks, it was a teenager, which makes a lot more sense. Cupid, who flies around with his bow and golden arrows, and when he shoots someone with a golden arrow, they fall in love with the first person they see. These stories did not come from a time when Cupid did that and an eyewitness reporter wrote it down. someone made the story, because what they're trying to say is, this is how love feels. It's a power that seems absolutely overwhelming. Sometimes it makes no sense at all. Sometimes we can fall in love with the strangest people. That may have happened to some of you. And the other person probably feels the same way. Same is true with justice. There's no such thing as justice in the sense that you can sit down and talk to it and say, all right, what do you want? What are we supposed to do? We make creatures of justice. We have Lady Justice. You all know the statue. She's made of stone. She's blindfolded. And she holds a scale in which she weighs objectively the facts to dispense true justice. But she has never spoken a word to us. What we have instead are the stories we tell about justice, the laws and the customs that the lawyers and the judges and the courts are under a sacred oath to try to serve. Same is true with America. You see the word America capitalized, you hear people talking about what America says or wants or does or is or demands. It isn't a critter you can sit down and interview. You'll never see America interviewed on television saying, here's what I am and here's what I want. But you hear the stories about America, and like all the other stories, they're controlled by the people who control the stories. Stories about God are the same. Some people tell stories about a God who wants war, wants obedience, dispenses punishment, and is a fearsome thing. Others tell stories about a God not like that at all. A God to whom war is an abomination, destroying his creations, slaughtering his children. If there's a real America, it never speaks up to correct us, and neither does God. What we have are the stories. If there really were a God, in the sense of a being more powerful than any we could imagine, we'd all know about it. There wouldn't be any mysteries left here. The rules would be clear, the punishments would be clear, and the bloody battles between the theological arrogances of Hindus, Muslims, Christians, and Jews could never have happened. There couldn't be hundreds or thousands of different beliefs if the beliefs mattered, because God, the goddess, or the gods would have settled it if they cared at all. But if we make the noises, then it's different. If we make the noises and the gods are concepts and ideas and sacred ideals rather than beings or critters, then the world would look much as it does today. We would spin out our stories like a spider spins her web, spinning it from yearnings and hopes and fears and needs inside of us, creating a world to live in and connecting it to those around us. And then, like Hanuman and Scheherazade, we would all tell our stories in order to live. And then everything would depend not on the gods, but on the quality of our stories. For now, our guiding myths would take on the role and the power of gods. Think about that ironic switch. The stories would create our worlds, giving us our meaning and purpose. This will begin sounding like the world we're living in. Competing stories that deny or ignore ours would be seen as dangerous rivals, threats to our world and our way of life. Those who believe differently could be dangerous enemies of the story that holds our world together, and they may deserve destruction or death for the sake of peace and love. Unless our stories were large enough to include all others as our beloved equals instead of our mortal enemies. And that would mean that the people who care for the stories or the world would have to attend to the quality of our most powerful stories, and that attending to our stories is one of the most powerful tasks we have. It would mean that when people degrade a word like God by turning it into mean and hateful things, we have to speak up. We must say, no, whatever the word God could mean, it could never be something that petty. Something that looked so much like your beliefs and so little like the beliefs of others. The same would be true of our other powerful words and stories. When justice is defined as something the poor cannot hope to afford, we must speak up and say, no, whatever Lady Justice wants, it must be more inclusive and just and merciful than that. When America is defined as a belligerent and imperialistic nation, claiming the divine right to invade and destroy weaker nations at will, we must speak up and say, no, an America worth loving may not be reduced to that level of warlike, bloody arrogance. If the gods were real, it would be our job to choose carefully and serve only the noblest and best among them. If they're merely powerful ideas and concepts, then it's our job to choose and serve only the noblest and best stories. Either way, our task is to develop an absolute relationship to absolute things, a relative relationship to relative things, and to strive to learn how to tell the difference between them. That means that either way, it's our move, both alone and together. It's our move.